Good evening. Let me just say I appreciate very much this week and appreciate the opportunity to make up what we had to miss last year, and enjoyed getting to know you all a little bit, and appreciated the hospitality of those who had us in the homes, and just wanted to let you know we both have enjoyed being here this week. We're looking at the charge tonight that you can't use the Bible to prove the Bible. And that charge is sometimes made against us, you know, that when people ask us, well, how are you going to prove the Bible to be true? And we go to the Bible, and they say, well, you know, that's not good. In fact, what they'll say is, well, that it's just a logical no-no. I mean, it's circular reasoning. And, on the surface, that sounds like a pretty good complaint, pretty good charge that's made. Because, yes, circular reasoning is erroneous. And, if I were going to say, for example, how would you prove that the Bible is inspired? And I went to a passage and said, this passage says it's inspired, therefore that proves it's inspired. Then that would be a reasonable charge. I can't prove it just by going to a passage that says it, any more than you can turn on the television and listen to a televangelist say, I'm inspired by God, the Spirit spoke to me, and that proves it. We understand that it takes more than just a claim, but the kinds of things we're talking about here really don't fit that kind of category. And on the surface, again, though, it sounds like a pretty good hit against those who believe the Bible to be true. Again, we would make the same kind of assumption or same kind of charge if we were talking to a Mormon and asking, how do you prove the Book of Mormon? They just quote the Book of Mormon. And so in that sense, that sounds like a pretty good thing, but there are some flawed assumptions in that, especially when it comes to the Bible. And I want us to address some of those assumptions. Really, this lesson tonight is in two parts. We're going to address some of the assumptions that are made, talk about that, and then we're going to spend a little bit of time looking at some examples in the New Testament of how, in fact, the gospel accounts do help prove one another. And we'll spend a little bit of time on that. But I'll start with some common problems. All right, so yeah, again, we don't want to say, well, the Bible says it, so therefore it must be right, in the sense that we haven't established its trustworthiness. Now, once you've established its trustworthiness, you can say, well, yes, the Bible says that. That's right. And we got to be careful with the kinds of claims that we're making. But the first part of this answer, really, there's some things we discussed last night that also kind of overflow into what we're going to talk about tonight. But if somebody made this charge to you, you can't use the Bible to prove the Bible, what would you start with? What would you say to someone who would tell you that? Well, I want to start with the most obvious fact about the Bible. And that is, it's many books, not just one. Now, the reason why this confuses people, I suppose, is because, I pick up my Bible and there it is. It's one book, right? But you know as well as I do, it's actually 66 books. It's not just one book. And the reason that's important is because when you think about it, I mean, ironically, to argue the Bible can't be used to prove itself really assumes, on the first hand, that there's actually a unity to the Bible that exists. The very thing they want to deny. But to say you can't use it to prove itself assumes that there's this unity there. Well, they can't have it both ways. And furthermore, we understand, I hope, that there's nothing wrong with writers using other sources when they write. I mean, Luke talks about investigating everything carefully, examining eyewitnesses in the first four verses of Luke 1. And we also have to recognize that Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John are all first century documents. There's no dispute about that. Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John are first century documents, as is what we talked about last night, 1 Corinthians and the epistles of Paul and so forth. No question about it. They were not compiled together into a single entity at the time of their writing. They were floating separately, if you will, around different places, but they weren't all compiled together yet. And again, the same thing with Paul and Peter. two more authors writing in the first century independently of the gospel accounts. Their works were not compiled together. Now, the issue of the canon of Scripture, which books belong in the Bible, that's another discussion. We don't have time to do that tonight. But the point is that it wasn't until later in the second century before these books began to get compiled together. And so they're not one book in that sense. They are separate works that were being passed around separately. And I think that the other thing that would kind of demonstrate the fallacious nature of this particular charge, imagine, if you will, that I gathered together the writings of, let's say, five scientists. And I said, I'm going to take your writings on a particular topic, and I'm going to compile them into one book. Now, after I've compiled them into one book, then I say, I'm sorry, you can't use the essay from this scientist to prove anything about the essay from that scientist because they're all in the same book. And you'd say, that's ridiculous. Well, that's what's going on with the Bible, friends. I mean, it's not just one entity. It's several books that were compiled together a little bit later. And if we can understand that, then you can see right off the bat that charge begins to fall apart. Secondly, I want to address the issue of history and inspiration. Mentioned this a little bit last night, because I believe this objection that you can't use the Bible to prove the Bible really conflates historical claims with the claims of inspiration. And we aren't just using the Bible's claims of inspiration to prove inspiration. Yeah, that would be a problem. But rather what we're doing is we're starting off with the history of it. Like we said, you've got to know what happened before you can understand the theological import of what happened. You have to start with the history before you can do anything else. Now, Craig Evans pointed out to a group of scholars dedicated to searching the historical question, he says, our approach is the same approach we would take if we were interested in the historical Alexander the Great or the historical Julius Caesar. I see, that's the evidence that anyone can examine just as they could any other historical claims. And if the historical claims bear out, then the discussion of inspiration can follow that later. And you, again, consider the opening lines of Luke's Gospel. We've referenced that. As he says, inasmuch as many have undertaken to compile an account of the things accomplished among us, just as they were handed down to us by those who from the beginning were eyewitnesses and servants of the word, it seemed fitting for me as well, having investigated everything carefully from the beginning, to write it out for you in consecutive order, most excellent Theophilus, so that you may know the exact truth about the things that have been taught. Now, I want you to notice there that Luke is not saying anything about inspiration, is he? Now, this is not a denial that it's inspired. It's just saying that that's not his initial focus. His initial focus is, here's what happened. And that's all he's really talking about right there. And so we're simply interested in this sense in what happened. And then we can go from there. So, you know, we can start that way and understand that once you get that, what happened in order, then you can move to the other discussions a little bit later. And tonight, we're not talking about inspiration. Tonight, we're talking about the historical claims. We're talking about what really happened here. And you'll notice here that the way Luke begins is not a fairy tale kind of beginning. Once upon a time, something happened. He's being very particular about this. Eyewitness testimony from the beginning. This is what's been reported. We're checking out these sources. We're making sure. I want you to know exactly what happened. And that's Luke's intent. For someone to say that we cannot use Luke's account to help verify anything in another book assumes that the history must somehow be flawed. To say that we cannot use Luke historically is to call into question, frankly, any work of ancient history. Why? Why do they call this into question? Well, the answer lies not in the counter evidence of the time, but it really lies in the problem of presuppositions. as Keener writes, a major reason some scholars doubted the Gospels to begin with was that they report miracles, which modern Western critics felt could not be attributed to eyewitnesses. So it's a presupposition against the miraculous, really. If this contained nothing about miracles, if this contained nothing about the supernatural, I don't believe there'd be a historian anywhere who'd question it. It would be easily accepted. If nothing supernatural is being written about, it's easy to accept. But there's a fundamental difference between the claims of history and the claims of inspiration. The claims of history are simply speaking to what actually happened. The claims of inspiration speak to the character and ultimate origin of the work. Those are two different questions. They're not the same question. The resurrection claim, for example, is about what really happened. And again, when we ask that question, was the same person who died seen alive again? All we're asking right there is a historical question. Somebody died, and somebody saw him alive again, and it was reported by eyewitnesses. How that happened is another question. But that it happened is a historical question. And that's all we're trying to look at here. And is the assumption that unbelievers are somehow in a better position to write about what really happened. This always strikes me, because sometimes people will say, you've got to have these other outside sources for it to make any kind of sense. Because if it's the Bible proving the Bible, then they're all biased, you see. And if they're biased, you really can't use them. Well, the one problem with that is simply the fact that every writer, anywhere, at any time, is going to have bias. I don't care who it is. For a critic today to say, we can't accept it because it has a bias, I'm going to have to turn around and say, I'm sorry, I can't accept what you say because you're biased too. It works both ways. And so bias alone doesn't mean anything. The question is it reliable? Did this really happen? That's really the question, whether the bias... And are unbelievers really in a better position to talk about this? If you understand from Luke's vantage point, from Matthew's vantage point, if they're writing about things that they were involved in, if they're writing about things that they spoke with eyewitnesses about, then who's in a better position to know what was happening? Them or people far removed from them? I think we know the answer to that question. I mean, if you were doing, let's say you wanted to do some research on the American Civil War, who's going to be your better source? Would it be better to go to somebody writing today about it and just see what their view of that is? Or would it be better to go back to the original sources and see what they said about it? What did the original source documents say? In other words, the people who were actually in the war writing about it. Here's what happened at this place. Who's in a better position to know? And you can't say, I'm going to discount what those guys had to say because they were biased when they wrote that. We don't do that. We understand that that doesn't work. Now, that said, there are other ancient writers who verify certain aspects of the Gospels. Josephus speaks of James, John the Baptist, Pilate, and Jesus, for example. Other historians and officials spoke of some of the people and referenced things like the crucifixion. But the point is, we can't expect unbelievers to argue for the resurrection. They do speak of certain mischievous beliefs of Christians, and clearly the growth of the church was based on belief in the resurrection. And they referenced enough to infer that the gospel writers did not just make everything up. They didn't just fabricate these accounts, which ought to be enough to promote further investigation of these accounts. If the authors were in a position to know what they were talking about, and they make it clear that their intent was to tell what really happened, then they need to be considered on their own merits. To deny the gospel writers that courtesy is to do so out of presuppositions against what they write about rather than the weight of the actual evidence. I think we need to recognize that. And what about potential conflicts? Using one book, one writer, to help testify about events recorded in another writer's work does not require proof that there are no conflicts or differences anywhere between the accounts. So let's just think about this historically for just a minute. If you're looking at what two historians wrote about something, let's say that they agree on the core issues that they're talking about, but they have some differences in the way they tell them, in the peripherals. Now, do most historians look at that and say, well, because they don't tell everything exactly alike and they have some differences over here, therefore, what they're writing about here didn't really happen? No, we don't do that. We don't operate that way when it comes to looking at historical documents. Because if that's made a requirement before you ever approach the text, then once again, nothing in anything, in any ancient history account can be trusted. There are plenty of things in what Josephus has to say that are questionable. And yet Josephus is considered a very good historian for his time at the end of the first century. We're not going to say, well, before we can believe this event, X, all accounts of it must be proven flawless with absolutely no differences before we can begin to accept that. Even witnesses in a courtroom might differ in some details that they're telling. But if they agree on the primary issue at hand, yes, I saw this person, here I saw this over here too, and then the other person comes along and says, yeah, I saw that same person, the jury can still come to a conclusion beyond a reasonable doubt about the truth of the core event. Let me give you a case in point. When the Titanic sunk, there were differences in the details of what people reported. Michael Icona in The Resurrection of Jesus wrote, the sinking of the Titanic is a good example because many eyewitnesses claim that the ship broke in two just prior to sinking. Other eyewitnesses said it all went down as one, intact. All right, now, we have records from eyewitnesses who said, no, the Titanic broke in half before it went down. Others said, no, it all stayed intact before it went down. Therefore, we conclude the Titanic never sunk, right? Why? Well, because they differ, so it must not have happened. Is that the way we operate? No, that's not the way we operate. We understand that they all agree on the main core issue, and that is that it went down, and we recognize, therefore, it did go down. Now, when the Titanic was found and examined in 1985, the team did conclude that the ship had been split apart prior to going down. But again, no one concludes that the Titanic didn't sink, and no one thought prior to finding the actual ship that the event didn't happen simply because some of the eyewitnesses differed in those accounts and we hadn't found it yet. The core was the same and they all agreed that it sunk. Now, when you examine the gospel accounts, are you going to find some differences in the way they tell some of the peripherals? Yes, you will. Does that mean they contradict? No, not necessarily. But here's my point. In order to make the case for the resurrection, I don't have to prove that there are no contradictions. All I have to do is show that there are ancient historical documents that all agree on the same core events. Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John, four separate independent accounts. Add to that Paul in 1 Corinthians and Peter. They all agree on the same core events. Jesus died, was buried, and he rose again. They all agree. So whatever else you want to say about the peripheral aspects of that, they all agree on the core events. And if we're going to approach this like we would approach any history, we're going to have to say, well, we've got to recognize the reality of what really happened here. And even without the gospel accounts, last night we spent some time talking about Paul. If you set aside Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John, you still got Paul to grapple with because, again, even skeptics admit that Paul wrote 1 Corinthians sometime between 50 and 54, and therein he testifies of the resurrection and how he was seen. Only about 20 years difference from the time of the event to the time that Paul was writing it. You still have to grapple with that. Point is that there are then several first century documents all agreeing, and you can say that's not right because it's all just one book. No, each one is its own account, his own writer, separate and independent from the others. They just happen to be compiled later. So how do we think about the gospel? Again, we referenced this a little bit last night. I think about the gospel as its own apologetic, as its own defense. The word of the cross is foolishness to those who are perishing, but to us who are being saved, it is the power of God, 1 Corinthians 1:18. In verse 22, he says, "For Jews that ask for signs and Greeks search for wisdom. We preach Christ crucified, the Jews a stumbling block, and the Gentiles foolishness, but to those who are called, both Jews and Greeks, Christ the power of God and the wisdom of God, because the foolishness of God is wiser than men, and the weakness of God is stronger than men." You think about the essence of the story of the gospel. An uneducated Jewish peasant from a small, obscure town in Galilee claims to be the Son of God, works miracles, teaches with authority, thereby silencing his opposition. His enemies, prominent Jewish leaders from Jerusalem, managed to get him arrested, charged, and crucified as a criminal by Roman authorities. 3 days later, he's risen. His disciples soon after begin to proclaim the death, burial, and resurrection of Jesus. And from this point, the disciples grow and spread to the rest of the world. A crucified, Jewish, uneducated peasant from Galilee is the Savior of the world? Again, many reject that story precisely because that sounds so foolish to them. But again, you're going to have to answer the question, where did it come from then? Who was able to come up with this story in such a way that everybody started buying into it so quickly? How does that happen? Well, there's no question but that the gospel story arose during the early part of the first century. No question about that. The story is claimed as historical, Luke 1, with the recognition that if it didn't happen, Christianity as a whole is false, 1 Corinthians 15. Everything hinges on its historical trustworthiness. So again, where did it come from? Would the story have arisen from within the Gentile community? Pagan Gentiles concocting a story about a Jewish peasant condemning their religious practices, whom they killed as a criminal? No, that's not going to happen. Well, then it must have come from the Jewish community. But which one? Which Jewish community? The idea of an uneducated Galilean Jew from an obscure family turns out to be the Son of God and long-promised Messiah? Which Jewish community was expecting their Messiah to be crucified on a Roman cross? None. None were. Why would they have invented the story of a man who condemned their attitudes and traditions as well? Keep in mind these points. To claim to be the Son of God was considered blasphemy. So they condemned him to die for it. To be crucified on a Roman cross was a curse. And he was put to death at the insistence of his own people while his handful of disciples scattered for fear. And the gospel accounts contain a number of what are called embarrassing facts, including the way the disciples acted. Fighting with one another over who's going to have the most power, making it unlikely that later disciples just invented these things to embarrass the apostles. And even Jesus. So you see, critics and those who think this is all legend have a problem here. Because they have nowhere from which the story could have come. Who's going to make this up? Wouldn't it come from the wealthy ruling classes who despised what Jesus stood for? And the poor uneducated Jews wouldn't have been able to write about it so eloquently. Who's going to do this? He was not a Messiah expected by any Jewish group. So which group invented them to be this way? But there it is. The story is here. And the irony is that those same details that make the critics think that the story is foolish also make the story that much more unlikely to have arisen from within any typical Gentile or Jewish community. Unless it really happened. And the only alternative is to think that a bunch of uneducated fishermen, in conjunction with a very educated Jewish Pharisee, were able to sell a fable that condemned all of them alike, gave them no cultural advantage, and had no other particular benefit except for false hope. Oh, and they had to be willing to stake their own lives on it as well, knowing all along that they were lying about it. What best accounts for the gospel story? The simplest answer, because that's what happened. Now what I want to do is kind of switch gears a little bit and give some examples in the gospel accounts themselves. You know, this goes back a ways in 1851. A man by the name of J.J. Blunt published a work called Undesigned Coincidences in the Writings of Both the Old and New Testaments, an argument for their veracity. This is actually available online as a PDF. So if you wanted to find it and get it, you can. I'd be happy to give you the website to that later. I had not heard of this until I saw the argument used by Dr. Tim McGrew, who's a philosopher and apologist. And so I owe several of these points to him. I'm gladly give him the credit for this. What is meant by undesigned coincidences? Well, McGrew says, sometimes two works by different authors interlock in such a way that would be very unlikely if one of them were copied from the other or both were copied from a common source. For example, one book may mention in passing a detail that answers some question raised by the other, and the two records fit together like a jigsaw puzzle. Fictions and forgeries aren't like this. So the idea here is that you might have in Matthew something that is said that is not explained. And you, if you're just reading Matthew, you might say, I don't get why that happened that way or what's going on. But then you read Luke talking about the same event, and he makes a statement that helps actually make more sense out of what happened over here in Matthew. Now, the best way to see this is simply to show it to you. And I'll give you several examples here. Let's start with Matthew chapter 4. Matthew chapter 4, in verses 18 through 22, we read about James and John mending their nets. Now, that's the only phrase I want to pick up on right now, is the fact that they were mending their nets. But if you just read Matthew, he doesn't tell you why that's happening that way, does he? Why are they mending their nets? And then when Jesus tells them to follow, that they just jump and go. Who would do that? I mean, if you were sitting there as a fisherman mending your nets, and somebody just walks along and says, hey, follow me, you're just going to jump up and follow them? Well, Matthew doesn't tell us any of that. But here's the interesting thing. If you turn to Luke chapter 5 and look at verse 6, we find out that the reason that all this is happening is that Jesus had already told them to put their nets into the water and that they had caught such a great amount of fish that caused them to be amazed that the nets were breaking in verse 6. So why were they mending their nets? Matthew doesn't tell us why, but Luke does. Luke says their nets had been breaking. Why? Because they had caught so many fish. And then in verse 9 tells us that great catch was so amazing to them that they were willing to follow. So why in Matthew would they just jump up and follow? Because they've already seen the miracle. They're bending their nets because the nets were breaking. And when Jesus says, come, they already know who he is at this point. They jump up and follow. That makes perfect sense. So the point is that Matthew compresses the events, where Luke expands on the particulars, and Luke's account explains what's going on in Matthew. Now, did Matthew and Luke sit down and collaborate with each other to put this stuff together? No evidence of that. But how does that happen? How do they both start talking about the same event and come up with the different details that actually make sense of each other? How does that just happen coincidentally? Especially if you're trying to make it up. All right, another example. Matthew chapter 9.
verses 9 and 10, tells us of the call of Matthew, the tax collector. And this is the disciple Matthew, of course. Now, here's what I want to draw attention to, is that verse 10 says that Jesus was reclining at the table in the house. In the house, that's all he said. But the question is, whose house? Well, Matthew doesn't say. Matthew didn't tell us that, which is interesting, because this is the call of Matthew. However, if you read, and the second question is, you know, what's the occasion of this? If you read Mark 2 and Luke 5, here's what you find out. In Mark 2 and verse 15, it clarifies it was his house. That is, it was the house of Matthew or Levi. So now we know whose house it was. It was Matthew's house. And Luke 5:29 specifies even further that Levi or Matthew, quote, gave a reception for Jesus at his house. So Matthew says the house. Mark says it was Levi's house, and Luke says the reason for this was that Levi gave a reception for Jesus. So in this sense, each account actually adds additional information to what's going on there, and together we can see how it all fits together. Were they just in collusion with each other? Now keep in mind that part of the point of this is to say, you know, when you stop and think what critics often say about the Gospels. If you say, why are there four Gospels instead of just one? And given that some stories are told in two or more Gospels, and sometimes in the very same words, can we compare them in such a way that we can know that they're authentic historical records? The skeptic says, well, one document must have been copied from another. And the common idea is that Mark wrote first and Matthew and Luke copied from Mark. And where Matthew and Luke agree with each other but include material different from Mark, they must have copied from another source they simply call Q, which has never been found on it. That's just a common assumption. But when you see this, how does this demonstrate that they're copying from each other when they're adding different details? And how does this account demonstrate that both Matthew and Luke copied from Mark, when Mark supplies a different detail than either of them supply? You see the point? That doesn't fit the scenario of just copying one another like that. Another example. Matthew 26, 67 and 68. They spat in the face of Jesus, it says, and they beat him with their fists, and others slapped him. And they said, prophesy to us, you Christ, who is the one who hit you? Now, this is Matthew's account, Matthew 26, 67, and 68. If you consider that for just a moment, does it seem a little odd that here they are beating on him and slapping him and saying, prophesy to us, who hit you? Now, you probably already know the answer. But the fact is, Matthew doesn't tell us why. And that may seem a little bit odd. Why would they be doing what? They're right in front of him. Wouldn't he know who hit him? No. Until you go to Luke 22 and see in verse 64 that they blindfolded him and were asking him, saying, prophesy, who is the one who hit you? So again, Matthew doesn't tell us they blindfolded. If all you read was Matthew, you wouldn't know Jesus was blindfolded. But Luke adds that little tidbit of information. And now when you come back to Matthew and you read it, now you know why they're saying that. He's blindfolded. He can't see. Matthew 8, verses 14 through 16. And I would encourage you just to write the verses down and read them in full a little bit later. It would take all night for us to do that with these. Matthew 8, 14 through 16 says that at evening they brought to Jesus many who were oppressed and sick. Now the question is, why evening? Especially if they believed that Jesus could heal, why would this be in the evening? Well, Matthew doesn't tell us that. But Mark does. And in Mark 21 in verses 29 through 32, we learn that it was the Sabbath. Matthew doesn't tell us that. So the question is, why does Matthew say that they're coming in the evening? Well, because it was the Sabbath, it would have been after that turnover in the evening that they would actually be doing this. So that makes perfect sense of what's going on. Luke 9 and verse 36. This is after the transfiguration. And the text in Luke 9, 36 simply tells us that, you know, Peter, James, and John, as they came down off the mountain, that they just kept silent. And they told no one what they had seen. That's all the text tells us there. The question is, why? Wouldn't you imagine, I mean, if you saw what happened, that you'd be eager to tell others about what you saw? So all Luke says is, they came down off the mountain, they were silent. Doesn't tell us why. But we learn in Mark 9 and verse 9 that Jesus charged them not to tell anyone. So Mark records the command. Luke records their obedience to the command. Together, they interlock, make perfect sense. All right, so does this make sense now? Here's one of the things I want you to really think about. As you read the gospel accounts, start looking for things like this. You might be reading one account and saying, well, wait a minute. Matthew doesn't mention this, and then you find over here, well, Luke does. And it makes sense of what Matthew says. But here's another one. In Mark 6, verse 31 and 39, this is the feeding of the 5,000. Now in Mark, Jesus tells the people to come away to a secluded place because it says that many were coming and going and they didn't have time to eat. And then he has them sit down on the grass. Now, the question is, what accounts for all of these people coming and going through Galilee? There's such great crowds, because normally it's not like it's that populated of an area. So what accounts for all of this? Well, what accounts for it is what we're told in John 6 and verse 4. And that is, it was Passover time. A time in which the roads of Palestine, not just Jerusalem, but the roads of Palestine would be swelling with crowds. So why were there crowds coming in and out at this time? Because it was Passover. So that makes sense of what Mark says. But here's another interesting one I find in Matthew, the 14th chapter, verses 1 and 2. We read that Herod had heard about Jesus and was saying to his servants that John had risen. Now here's the question. Why was Herod speaking like this to his servants? And how did Matthew know about it? I mean, if you're just looking at it strictly historically here, you'd ask, well, how does Matthew know that Herod is speaking to his servants about this? Well, Luke chapter 8 and verse 3 tells us that among those who attended to the disciples of Jesus, providing for their needs, was a woman named Joanna, and she's called Herod's household manager. So in other words, one of Herod's servants, who happens to be his manager, I mean, she's got a pretty important position, is also attending to the disciples. And so you've got this transition over between the two. So that's how Matthew would know, and that's why he would be talking to her about it. Mark 14, verse 58, and Mark 15 and verse 29. Both record the accusations at the cross that Jesus could allegedly rebuild the temple in 3 days. Now the interesting thing about that, and I realize this could be explained just as simply a false charge. There's no record in Matthew, Mark, or Luke of Jesus saying anything like that. He said, destroy this temple in 3 days, I'll raise it up. But you know where we're going, don't you? Because in John 2, 18 and 19, that's exactly what Jesus said. Destroy this temple and in 3 days, I'll raise it up. Now, they misinterpreted it. They didn't understand what he meant. He's speaking about the resurrection there. But still, that's the statement that he makes that Matthew, and or in this case Mark, says that these witnesses came forward and said, this is what Jesus claimed. And so, yeah, he did say something like that. John 21. Remember when Jesus was asking Peter whether he loves him more than the others? You know, in John 21, 15. Why is Jesus asking Peter this? You know, John doesn't tell us. John just says he takes Peter and asks him these particular questions. But I believe we have a key to this answer in Matthew 26, 33 and 34. Because this is where Peter boasts, though all may fall because of you, I will never fall away. And you remember what Jesus told him at that point? You will deny me three times. Here's my question then. Does this boast, coupled with Peter's three denials, help explain why Jesus asked Peter that same question three times? Do you love me? It seemed pretty likely. Peter denies him three times. Jesus asked him three times about this. And Peter's the one who boasted about it. John records essentially how they're reconciled. Now here's one that I find interesting. Let's turn to Luke 23 for just a moment. I want you to notice, this is in verses 2 through 4. I want you to notice the order of events here. It's kind of a strange sequence of events. They began to accuse him, saying, we found this man misleading our nation, forbidding to pay taxes to Caesar, saying that he himself is Christ, the king. So Pilate asked him, saying, are you the king of the Jews? And he answered and said, it is as you say. Then Pilate said to the chief priests and the crowds, I find no guilt in this man. Now, wait a minute. The Jews accused Jesus. Pilate questions Jesus. Jesus admits to the charge, and then Pilate declares Jesus innocent. If you're just kind of reading that, you might go, huh? How did this happen? Why would Pilate declare him innocent after he just admitted to this charge? Because that seems to come out of nowhere. Well, here's the answer. Is in John, the 18th chapter. And again, this is kind of a lengthier discussion that Pilate has with Jesus. But in John, the 18th chapter, in verse 33, Pilate entered into the praetorium and summoned Jesus and said, are you the king of the Jews? Jesus answered, are you saying this on your own initiative or did others tell you about me? Pilate answered him, I'm not a Jew, am I? Your own nation and chief priests delivered you to me. What have you done? Jesus answered, my kingdom is not of this world. If my kingdom were of this world, my servants would be fighting so that I would not be handed over to the Jews. But as it is, my kingdom is not of this realm. Pilate said, so you are a king? Jesus answered, you correctly say that I'm a king. For this I've been born and for this I've come into this world to testify to the truth. Everyone who's of the truth hears my voice. Pilate said, what is truth? Well, what's happening here? Well, basically what you have is, in John, Pilate's question, are you the king, seems to come out of nowhere. Why would he just ask him if he's the king? In Luke, Pilate pronouncing Jesus innocent seems to come out of nowhere. Why would he pronounce him innocent? But together they make sense. Luke shows the accusation. He's claiming to be a king. They don't give the full answer. John gives the full answer without showing the accusation. You put them together, it makes sense. And you know, John would have written sometime after Luke, by the way. And while we're in John 18, in John 18 and verse 10, recall here where Peter cuts off the high priest's servant's ear, Malchus, and Jesus tells him to put the sword away. Then in verse 36, as we just read, Jesus tells Pilate that if his kingdom were of this world, his servants would be fighting. Now we might wonder, Doesn't Peter cutting off the ear with the sword constitute fighting? And why wasn't Peter arrested for this? Well, John doesn't explain that. But Luke 22 and verse 51 gives us the clue. But Jesus answered and said, "Stop, no more of this." And he touched his ear and healed him. You know, John doesn't tell us that Jesus healed the man's ear. But Luke does. And now there's no evidence of the struggle. Think about that. Peter couldn't be arrested. Jesus couldn't be contradicted in his claims. Putting both them together shows that it makes sense. You know, if they said, "Well, no, wait a minute. Peter cut off the ear of that man." And they said, "Well, look at his ear." Oh. We have no evidence of the struggle. And Jesus told them to stop. So, what Jesus said is perfectly true. But you look at both those accounts and you can see why. There's a number of others that we can go through. I'm going to skip past this last one for time's sake. It takes a little while to go through. But I just want to mention here, there's kind of a cumulative force. And boy, there are many others. I mentioned McGrew, where he makes a statement that becomes ridiculous to insist that they're all just accidental. There comes a point. You know, if you just, you know, come across one of these, or maybe a couple or something like that, you might say, "Well, yeah, that really is just mere coincidence." But when you start reading the gospel accounts, and by the way, you find the same phenomenon in the Old Testament. When you're reading the Kings and Chronicles and so forth, you'll find some of the same kinds of things going on there. And McGrew's wife, Lydia, recently just came out with a book specifically on this particular issue. There are many more. And the point is, as you're reading and studying and learning, you'll find that this is happening constantly. And so the question is, at what point do you say, this is more than just accidental? There's something else going on here with these words that are not just merely coincidental. And it's important to recognize that this kind of thing happening between these types of accounts really is evidence not of fabrication, not of just making things up, not fables, not myths, not legends, but it is characteristic of talking about what really happened. And that makes sense. Let's take our songbooks out that was prepared to be sung tonight. I'll tell you, Bible study is exciting to me because every time you turn around, there's something else, there's something new, there's something else that you know, you didn't see before. There is a depth and a beauty the Bible study, and if all you're going to do is look at it superficially, you know, and try to make charges of contradiction and all of that, and fail to look deeper and see, you know, the deeper meaning involved, it's just not right. Scripture is filled with wonder and beauty. And we need to learn to see that. It's like an interwoven tapestry, a web that's connected together in multiple layers, not just a flat line kind of a reading, but multiplied layers of interconnection. We're going to see that for what it is. But really, Bible study is not just about getting information. The Apostle Paul writes in Romans 12 that we need to be transformed by the renewing of our mind. But really what it's about is transformation. Turning us into new people made in the image of Christ. And to do that, we need to be conformed to His death, burial, and resurrection. Romans 6 teaches us when we are buried with Him in baptism, we are dead in our sins, we are buried, we are raised up to walk in new life, and therefore are conformed to His death, burial, and resurrection. And if you haven't done that,
we can help you. If you need our prayers, let us know as we stand.